Hello and welcome to PM. I'm Ashley Hall. Among our stories tonight, the legal battle against the same-sex marriage postal survey reaches the High Court, with activist groups arguing it should be stopped because of the way it's been funded. The Trump administration warns North Korea is begging for war and asks China and other members of the Security Council to cut off all oil and other fuel to the country. And the head of the Anglican Church in Australia announces new rules to prevent child sexual abuse in the church.
We profoundly regret that this abuse has happened, and we regret that when abuse was often brought to the attention of the church, that we didn't respond to it appropriately. And so we think these are strong measures that will give a lot more confidence to the child protection within the Anglican Church of Australia.
Two gay rights activist groups have launched a High Court bid to stop the same-sex marriage postal survey going ahead. They argue the way the government's funded the vote is unlawful. If they're successful, the $122 million given to the Australian Bureau of Statistics to carry out the survey could be at risk. PM reporter Jane Lee has been in court today in Melbourne.
The High Court building in Melbourne is usually a sedate place for lawyers and their clients. But on Tuesday morning, the queue of journalists and members of the public snaked around the court's lobby and went all the way out to the street. They're all here for one thing, to get a glimpse of the battle against the same-sex marriage postal survey.
It was not an easy decision to decide to subject my family, my partner Sarah, my three kids, to this kind of government and political and public scrutiny. But I'm doing it because I want to be able to say to them that we did everything we could, and the last thing we could do was take this government to the High Court to stop the postal plebiscite. And that's why I'm here today.
That's Felicity Marlowe, a mother of three who has been with her partner Sarah for 17 years. Ms. Marlowe, a spokeswoman for Rainbow Children, is challenging the postal survey alongside independent MP Andrew Wilkie and Brisbane gay rights advocacy group PFLAG.
Families like mine and trans and gender diverse young people have already, without the campaign even being started, been subjected to vile hate and abuse. I am deeply concerned about the long-term impact of any 8-week public campaign on a postal plebiscite and the impact it will have on the mental health and well-being of children like mine and trans and gender diverse young people.
The group is attacking every step of the process used to bring the survey about. They've argued in the High Court that Finance Minister Matthias Cormann had no legal authority to advance the $122 million for the survey to the Australian Bureau of Statistics. They say this is because the law he used is akin to a blank cheque that bypasses parliamentary processes. They also say the Australian statistician cannot lawfully run the survey because under the Constitution, it can only collect statistics, not votes on whether to legalise same-sex marriage. One of their lawyers is Jonathan Hunyor from the Public Interest Advocacy Centre.
We also have serious concerns about undermining the integrity of institutions like the Australian Electoral Commission and the Australian Bureau of Statistics in a process that is neither really about statistics nor is it about an election. A postal vote is unnecessary, it's unfair, and it's Parliament's job to decide issues like this. They're the things that we're asking the High Court to decide today so that Parliament can get on and do its job and legislate for marriage equality.
The second group challenging the survey includes Greens Senator Janet Rice and Australian Marriage Equality. The group's co-chair is independent MP Alex Greenwich.
We can have marriage equality in the next fortnight, but if we have to be put through this postal vote plebiscite, we're here because we should at least make sure it's a legally viable process.
They say that because the Turnbull government went to the election promising to hold a plebiscite on same-sex marriage if it won, it doesn't have the power to spend money on the survey using a law designed for emergency spending. Anna Brown is one of the group's lawyers from the Human Rights Law Centre.
These are important issues and principles of government accountability and the rule of law. But above all, this case is about the dignity and equality for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender and intersex Australians.
The two groups have told the High Court they wanted to declare that the funding needed for the survey to go ahead is unlawful. They also want a declaration that the Australian statistician is not legally authorised to conduct the survey. The High Court hearing will continue tomorrow, when lawyers for the government will defend its legal right to fund the survey. The court's decision is still some way off, but Finance Minister Matthias Cormann has told ABC in a statement that the survey forms and letters for the postal vote are already being printed, because it will take some time for them to print and dry. but he says the forms will not be mailed to eligible voters until next Tuesday.
Jane Lee in Melbourne with that report. The United States says North Korea is begging for war and that any country doing business with the rogue nation is helping its reckless and dangerous nuclear intentions. The South Korean military says there's again activity at one of North Korea's known missile launch sites. Leader Kim Jong-un could be planning another launch to mark a significant day in the North Korean calendar. This Saturday is the day of the foundation of the Republic, recognising the day in 1948 when the current leader's grandfather, Kim Il-sung, proclaimed the Republic. Rachel Milley reports from Tokyo.
A South Korean intelligence source has been quoted in the press today saying a North Korean missile, possibly an intercontinental ballistic missile, was moved last night under cover of darkness towards a known launch site on North Korea's west coast. At daybreak, the South Korean Navy showed its hand, conducting massive live fire drills in the sea off the Korean peninsula. As well, the South Korean President Moon Jae-in spoke to US President Donald Trump. Together, they agreed to scrap a weight limit on South Korean warheads. This means the South would be able to respond with greater force in the event of a military conflict. A South Korean Defense Ministry spokesman made sure to point out that denuclearization was still the priority.
We expect such change to help in finding better solutions to North Korea's threats, and our government will continue to closely cooperate with the US on detailed matters.
Last night in New York, the UN Security Council held an emergency session. The council will vote next week on a proposal to once again tighten the sanctions against North Korea. Stephen Nagy is a professor of international relations at Tokyo's Christian University. He says the effectiveness of the sanctions hinge on Russia and China, and both countries might have already hit their limit in terms of how far they're prepared to go.
I think that they'll agree to the sanctions, but they won't enforce the sanctions, or they'll enforce them in a way that's rather weak, which will allow them to continue to trade with the North Koreans and maintain the North Korea's, try to ensure that the North Korean regime remains intact.
The UN also discussed a proposal which has become known as the Freeze for Freeze, where the US and South Korea would suspend their military exercises in return for the suspension of North Korean missile tests. But the US ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, was quick to rule it out.
We will defend our allies and our territory. The idea that some have suggested a so-called freeze for freeze is insulting. When a rogue regime has a nuclear weapon and an ICBM pointed at you, you do not take steps to lower your guard.
Professor Nagy says the U.S. could give some ground on this proposal without lowering its guard.
I do think it's false bravado to say that the North represents an existential threat to the United States and that they can't find a way to somehow de-escalate on the peninsula, whether it's just in a way that may allow the North Koreans to save face or in a way that is a little bit more substantial. It's an argument that I don't really find based in facts.
He says the freeze for freeze proposal could be a concrete way out of the current crisis.
Perhaps stepping back and finding a way to downscale it or do it in a different location may, in the short term to midterm, damper some of the tensions on the peninsula and create the opportunity for some dialogue and to move forward in along discussions, whether it's a peace treaty or a non-aggression treaty or otherwise.
Professor Nagy says another test is imminent and his money's on the next missile being sent over mainland Japan into the Pacific. This is Rachel Mealy in Tokyo for PM.
The Anglican Church of Australia has introduced new rules it says will ensure no more children are sexually abused in its care. The Safe Ministry for Children canon was passed unanimously today at the church's triennial General Synod in Queensland. It includes a new code of conduct for clergy and standards for screening church workers. But sexual assault survivors and legal experts question whether the new rules go far enough. Flint Duxfield reports.
In its recent inquiries into the Anglican Church, the Royal Commission into Child Sexual Abuse received over 1,000 complaints of abuse across nearly all the dioceses in the country. It's a history of abuse the head of the Anglican Church in Australia, Archbishop Philip Freer, says must be addressed.
We profoundly regret that this abuse has happened, and we regret that when abuse was often brought to the attention of the Church, that we didn't respond to it appropriately, and we didn't listen to people and understand their pain and their need for healing.
At its triennial synod in Queensland today, the Anglican Church passed new rules the Archbishop says will do just that. The Safe Ministry for Children canon will mandate a code of conduct for all clergy and church workers and screening processes, including working with children checks, in each state. Survivors group Broken Rights has welcomed the announcement, but spokesperson Dr. Wayne Chamley says he's not confident the new rules will ensure sexual abuse perpetrators are appropriately reported.
It becomes difficult because often there's very close friendships have been established between very good people and people who are not so good. And then you get this compromise, of not reporting and looking it the other way.
Archbishop Freer says the Church already has a mandatory reporting framework for any instances of sexual abuse, which the new rules will strengthen by introducing increased public accountability.
There'll be external auditing of the processes we and the policies we have, because it's one thing to have great policies, but we really want to be sure that they're being implemented and carried out. So I think at that end it's going to be fairly rigorous.
But legal experts warn the audit process may not go far enough. Michelle James is National Head of Abuse for Maurice Blackburn, which represents survivors of sexual abuse.
The consequences of failing to adhere to these new standards passed by the Anglican Church are unclear. What the Church says is that there will be regular independent audits and that the results of those audits will be published publicly. And in that sense, they say that they will be publicly accountable. But of course, it's clear that being publicly accountable is not the same as being criminally accountable. And we would say that it's important that the recommendations of the Royal Commission around failure to report offences of child and sexual abuse, that those criminal standards should be enacted by the states and territories.
Michelle James from the law firm Maurice Blackburn, ending Flint Duxfield's report. The government's plans to change citizenship rules look doomed this afternoon. Key crossbench Senator Nick Xenophon and his team say they can't support the changes, which would have introduced tougher language tests, a new test on Australian values, and a four-year waiting period to acquire citizenship. Political reporter Tom Eagledon spoke with Senator Xenophon a few minutes ago.
Well, we'll be meeting with the government in relation to the bill, but we've made it very clear from the committee report that's been tabled today that we have very serious concerns about the bill in its current form. So the bill will simply not pass in its current form.
Which is of the major items that the government wanted to change is of the most concern?
Look, a number of concerns. There's the whole issue of the English language test with a university standard English literacy that's required that I think members of parliament, maybe even me, would have difficulty in passing. But there's also the issue of the four-year residency requirement, permanent residence requirement, before you can become a citizen, which in essence would be retrospective. By applying it now, that would cause all sorts of issues. The value statement isn't a bad idea, but simply having it in the hands of the minister and something that it should be something that the parliament should determine. So there's a whole range of measures in the bill that we think went too far and really go against the grain of Australia being a great multicultural country. After all, something like one in two Australians were either born overseas or have one parent born overseas. So that's been our great strength as a country.
One of the other things that was being proposed was basically the power of the Administrative Appeals Tribunal to overturn certain citizenship decisions was going to be ended. Is that something that you could support if negotiations continue?
That is always problematic in terms of taking away appeal rights. I understand the government's concerns in relation to that, but simply taking away appeal rights in that way was a real concern for us. Look, insofar as issues of Australian values, that is an important issue. I think that the government will either have to put in a new bill or agree to very significant amendments to this bill. But at this stage, this bill is very problematic for us as a team.
The government, of course, argued that in this these days and in these times, these sorts of changes were needed. A hint there that there were some national security issues perhaps at play here. Were you swayed by any of those arguments?
National security issues are very important and they need to be dealt with as that, not through some other mechanism, through a citizenship bill. If there are any threats to our country, if there are individuals that will put Australian lives at risk, then that must be dealt with effectively without compromise. But this bill is a citizenship bill, not a national security bill. If there's a national security bill the government wants to put up to make sure Australians can be safer, then we'd welcome that. But this bill is not the way to do it.
Now, I've spoken with Peter Dutton, the Immigration Minister's office, this afternoon. They say that they're continuing to speak with the crossbench. Are negotiations over as far as you're concerned, or can you see even a dim potential that perhaps there could be a way through here?
Look, it would be wrong not to speak to the government. I think as a general principle, you should speak to the government, the opposition, key crossbenchers on important pieces of legislation. Always happy to speak to the Immigration Minister, but there are simply too many concerns about this bill in its current form. There would have to be a very substantial redrawing of it, or the bill is withdrawn and a new bill is put up.
Have you put any proposals of your own to replace the ones that you do have problems with?
I will be meeting with the minister later this evening and we'll be discussing that. And I think it's important to put this in perspective. If there are genuine national security concerns, that should be dealt with through national security legislation, not through a citizenship bill.
Crossbench Senator Nick Xenophon speaking with political reporter Tom Eagledon. And staying with federal politics, the Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has revealed he's been in talks with energy company AGL about keeping one of its major coal-fired power stations operating until 2027, 5 years later than planned. Mr Turnbull says it's part of his plan to keep energy prices down, but Labor argues the government should be focused on developing a clean energy target. Stephanie Dalzell reports.
For the second question time in a row, Labor was sticking with the party's plan to create chaos around the government's citizenship saga. But the Prime Minister largely ignored Labor's questions and instead answered questions from coalition backbenchers about energy prices.
While the opposition has spent the past fortnight talking up their plans to try to make the House of Representatives appear chaotic, what we have done is stay focused squarely on the issues that matter to Australian families and businesses. And we're delivering measure after measure that is putting downward pressure on energy prices.
The Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull referenced a report from the Australian Energy Market Operator which addresses potential shortages in energy capacity. It found the likelihood of a shortfall or load shedding, where power companies are asked to switch off when the electricity grid is at risk, is as high as 43% in Victoria and 33% in South Australia. And Malcolm Turnbull was quick to lay blame.
What it shows is a sorry tale of Labor mismanagement, particularly in South Australia and in Victoria. And it's left our national electricity market vulnerable.
The Prime Minister also revealed he has been in talks with energy company AGL to keep one of its major coal-fired power stations, Liddell, operating until 2027.
The Energy Minister and I are already in discussions with the owner of Liddell, AGL, about how we can ensure that that power station stays in operation for at least another 5 years after 2022. And Mr Speaker, how has the Labor Victorian government responded to this crisis? More of the same mistakes, calling for more renewables with no backup.
As both sides moved to set the agenda for today's debate, neither would engage with the other's line. With 10 minutes left on the clock for question time, Labor swiftly swatted energy away and turned its attention back to citizenship. Tony Burke moved to suspend standing orders to call on the government to stand aside Barnaby Joyce until the High Court rules on his eligibility. But the plan was dealt a blow when the Leader of the House, Christopher Pyne, made his own move to gag Tony Burke.
I move the member be no longer heard.
The Leader of the House has moved. The Leader of the House has moved that the Manager of Opposition Business be no further heard. All those of that opinion say aye.
Aye.
To the contrary, no.
No.
I think the ayes have it. Division required.
The government's motion was successful. It still has a slim but very important majority. After question time, the opposition's Mark Butler told PM the government should be focusing on developing a clean energy target instead of breathing life into coal-fired power stations.
We don't know that those discussions are going anywhere quickly because we've seen very clear public comments from AGL that they don't see any attraction in investing in new coal-fired power stations or in investing in the extension of the Liddell power station beyond 2022, which would cost them many, many millions of dollars.
That's the Shadow Minister for Climate Change, Mark Butler, ending that report by Stephanie Dalzell. And just a short time ago, AGL released a statement saying it's committed to the closure of the Liddell power station in 2022, which is the end of its operating life. Australia's biggest salmon company, Tassal, has won back a sustainability certificate for its fish farms on Tasmania's west coast. The Aquaculture Stewardship Council, or ASC, provides independent approval for fish farms, but the ASC had warned Tassal it needed to clean up its operations in Macquarie Harbour to keep the certification. The head of sustainability at Tassal, Linda Sams, is speaking to reporter Felicity Ogilvie.
We're extremely pleased to have achieved ASC at our two sites in Macquarie Harbour, Gordon and Middle. We closed out all the non-conformities that were identified. It's been a tough year. We've worked really hard at it, and this is a really, really nice reward for all that hard work.
Tassal has been under a lot of scrutiny over the past year about your salmon farming practices. The EPA has closed down a lease in Macquarie Harbour because of environmental damage. What does it mean for the company to get this ASC certification for the two leases?
Well, it means that Tassal is very resilient. We have a culture of compliance. We do have a culture of real pride in our environmental performance. And across the rest of the company, again, very excellent compliance record. Since I've been here, it's been a real focus for us. So for us, I guess it means we picked ourselves up, dusted ourselves off, kept to our commitments with the EPA, commitments to the community, and commitment to the environment.
The company doesn't have ASC approval for the lease that has been closed down because of non-compliance. Will you ever get that back for the Franklin lease?
Yeah, we chose not to pursue ASC at that site towards the end of the harvest, and that was a voluntary removal of the ASC certification due to all the challenges we had with non-compliances. The fact that we're not certifying it now or it's not under assessment is due to the fact that it has no fish on it. So the site has to come back into a level of compliance where the pen bays were before we'll restock. At this point, it's pretty early to decide whether that's going to happen or not in 2018, but early indications, we're very, very confident that we'll actually be able to put a 2018 year class in. When we do that, we'll definitely go under assessment for ASC.
Will that be as if Tassal is starting the ASC approval process again for the 266 lease?
Every time that we do a full reassessment, you do start from scratch. And the standard gets harder every year. We were one of the very first companies to certify to the standard in 2014. And every year, the standard gets a little tougher to meet. So, yes, every time we do it for a new site or a restocking of a site, it's a full assessment.
With the two sites that are ASC certified in Macquarie Harbour at the moment, Tassal did have problems with Bedgiatoa bacteria mats under the leases. What has happened to that bacteria?
So what we have seen is there's a couple things. So when we reduce densities or we fallow a site or there's changing natural conditions, you can see changes in the Bedgiatoa extent. Now we have full compliance at our 35-metre compliance areas. We always see some level of Bedgiatoa on the sites under the cages because they're there and they actually process the waste. So they are a sign of enrichment and you'd expect to see that. So right now we're pretty happy with how everything's looking. Everything is within compliance.
The head of sustainability at Tassal, Linda Sams, with Felicity Ogilvie. A parasitic worm that's endemic to several developing countries could also infect up to 60% of adults living in Indigenous communities in northern Australia. But health professionals warn there's no way of knowing how many Australians are infected because there's not enough screening being done. Strongyloides stercoralis lives in the gastrointestinal system and, if untreated, can be fatal. Doctors are also worried a drug-resistant strain already prevalent in farm animals might mutate. Stephen Smiley explains.
Living in the stomach and intestines, the Strongyloides stercorales worm infects 370 million people worldwide. In patients, its symptoms can include diarrhea, coughing and a hives-like rash. And if undiagnosed and untreated, it can be fatal. Kirsten Ross is a senior lecturer in environmental health at Flinders University in Adelaide and is part of a working group studying the worm.
One of the features of the organism is that it lives in your intestinal tract for a very, very long time. So we have been seeing cases in people returning from overseas that have got the infection many, many years ago.
Among those returning from overseas who've contracted the parasite are ex-prisoners of war and veterans of the Vietnam War. And there's been another big group of Australians living with the worm who've been infected right in their own backyards. In Indigenous communities on Cape York, in the Gulf Country of Queensland and the Northern Territory, and in East Arnhem Land, no one knows how many people have it.
We have communities that other clinicians are working with where they've got a reasonable idea of the infection rate, and that seems to sort of hover between sort of 5 and 60% infection. Because we don't routinely test for it, we actually probably don't really know, we don't have a really good hold on the numbers.
If diagnosed quickly enough, strongyloidiasis can be treated with a drug called ivermectin. But if left undiagnosed too long, the worm can go on to a phase called hyperinfection, in which it reproduces rapidly, potentially killing the patient. Dr. Wendy Page is part of Kirsten Ross's working group and is a GP who's worked from a clinic in East Arnhem Land for 2 decades. She says there have been fatal cases of strongyloidiasis in Australia because it wasn't picked up quickly enough.
Many years ago, a colleague passed away. An Aboriginal health worker died from disseminated strongyloidiasis. And we realised that we needed to be screening people coming through. And that's what we do as part of an adult health check.
Wendy Page says in recent years, the screening program she and her colleagues in East Arnhem Land are running has saved lives.
One example we have, a 2-year-old brought in from Western North Queensland in a life-threatening situation, but strongyloides was recognised as being the factor behind why this child was continuing to deteriorate. And once it was identified, they were able to treat that child. Now, without being aware, that would have been another statistic.
Wendy Page wants a central database of strongyloidiasis diagnoses. She says without it, nobody really knows how many Australians have the parasite or how many might be dying from what's a treatable condition.
It would mean that each case would go onto a database and you'd say, oh, we've got a hotspot here, what's happening there? We need to go out and find out, work with that community to see what needs to be done. It's been considered the most neglected of neglected tropical diseases. It's something that we can do something about, but if people aren't aware to begin with, then nothing happens and it gets put to the side and it's ignored. And so people suffer who should not have to suffer. And when we look at our own Indigenous populations, there's no reason why they should have to suffer from a disease that's preventable and treatable.
That's East Arnhem Land GP Wendy Page ending that report by Stephen Smiley. What do you do if the league axes your favourite team? Well, if you're mining magnate Andrew Twiggy Forrest, you just start your own rugby union competition. It's a punt the billionaire businessman hopes will attract top players and advance the sport in the Indo-Pacific region. But the union representing players is worried about what it all means for its members. Penny Timms reports.
Andrew Twiggy Forrest was never going to take his team's ditching from the Super Rugby competition by the Australian Rugby Union well. And when news came through that the Western Force today lost its Supreme Court appeal against its axing, Twiggy showed he's not here to play by halves.
What I want to announce is the new Western Force and the new game of rugby across the Indo-Pacific.
If things go his way, the new game will be a rival competition made up of 6 teams across the Indo-Pacific region.
We will include strong and deeply powerful players, broadcasters and fans of rugby all across the Indo-Pacific region, where some 60% of the world's people live on our time frame right here in Western Australia.
Andrew Forrest says the new competition will also aim to attract more women into rugby union. He describes it as a new and bright dawn for Australian rugby, though it won't be an easy feat. The Players Association says it's focused on what impact today's court ruling will have on the well-being of players and their families.
So our advice to the players this morning when we met with them was to take their time. Naturally, again, it is a highly distressing situation.
That's Ross Zeno, the chief executive of the Rugby Union Players Association. He says existing Western Force players have a lot to consider, and the proposed Indo-Pacific competition may not just be a pipe dream. Matt Hodgson is the captain of the Western Force and says he'd happily put his hand up to be part of the new competition.
We're all about giving rugby and giving people opportunity, and we represent that, and I think the AAU could probably learn a bit from what we're doing over here.
He stood shoulder to shoulder with Western Force players and staff, many visibly upset by the news that their bid to save their club has failed so far.
See what it means to people? You get 12 years serving a state, serving a country, and they take it away from a stupid lettering of the law. But we're lucky we've got people here fighting. Pity what the AAU didn't fight for us. So.
And Twiggy didn't leave without taking a final swipe at the AAU.
Discussions have commenced across the world and within our own state and country to ensure this competition starts and starts strongly and continues strongly, so that by the time 2020 rolls around, where the Western Force should have had its day, should have had its years, should have no doubt, I think, if allowed, if not so heinously cut down by the chairman of the AAU, who made a very poor financial decision to not approach people like me, to turn down an offer for $50 million, which is without record or precedent in Australian sport, to not grow the game and not strengthen it, but to shrink it. I consider that a very poor decision. I again call for the chairman of the AAU to join the honourable path of his chief executive and resign.
Cameron Klein is the chairman of the Australian Rugby Union and says his future is up to the AAU's members to decide. And he says despite today's court ruling in the AAU's favour, it's not a day for celebration.
You know, clearly it's a very disappointing day for you know, people in WA, and I've got an enormous sympathy for what people like Matt Hodgson are going through. You know, he's put a huge amount into that club. And I fully understand, you know, why he's upset. So I'm happy that we've got resolution in the sense that we're now able to proceed with a 15-team competition, which is a far better Super Rugby format than we've had in the past.
But he also put the onus of the outcome largely on Rugby WA, saying it failed to come up with an adequate solution and should have contacted Andrew Forrest for help much sooner.
Penny
Mr. Klein wouldn't be drawn on the proposed new rival competition.
That's Penny Timms with that report. Firefighters are bracing for one of the worst fire seasons on record. They say warmer conditions have been coupled this year with a particularly dry winter. And they're urging residents to be prepared for an early start to the fire season. Serena Locke reports.
There's no escaping the evidence of a drying climate in southern Australia. The Bureau of Meteorology's Dr. David Jones.
The southwest of Western Australia has been getting dry now for about 40 years. The southeast of Australia has been getting dry for about 20 years.
Victoria's fire season is now 50% longer than it used to be. Craig Lapsley is Commissioner of Emergency Management in Victoria, and he says hot, dry winds are forecast from off central Australia.
Fire intensity, particularly watching New South Wales, we're already seeing some fires in the very eastern part of Victoria be difficult to manage, and that's in winter, moving into spring. So I think it's very clear for all of the states, particularly the southern states, the eastern seaboard, where the communities live, that we've got a very high risk. The early indicators are telling us to take this very serious, is my view.
New South Wales is facing worse conditions this year than in 2013. And Shane Fitzsimmons, the New South Wales RFS Commissioner, says already there have been 2,500 fires in his state in August.
The vegetation moisture levels today are considerably drier and showing a worse situation than they were leading into the 2013 fire season, for example.
Do you expect to see yourself standing in front of cameras declaring catastrophic fire danger days?
Look, I hope not. But as we saw only in February of this year, even without widespread concerns for above normal conditions, if the elements come together, if the landscape dryness is there, if the onset of temperatures, low humidity, very dry air and strong winds come together, we could see catastrophic conditions again. We can't rule that out, but obviously I hope we don't.
For New South Wales, the window for hazard reduction burns has almost closed. It will be relying heavily on volunteers plus 100 aerial fire bombers, which have already started work.
We've already seen Thor, the large air tanker, arrive in country and start its contract on the 1st of September, which was last Friday. And as a matter of fact, on that day, it was called up to assist with firefighting operations up around Port Macquarie on the mid-north coast. On the 1st of October, the first of the air cranes arriving. We will then see the 1st of November, the DC-10 arriving again, and then we'll see another crane arriving in December. So we will see a number of key assets arriving into the state leading up to what is typically the greatest concentration of fire season as we move into the full summer period over Christmas and the New Year.
Queensland's fire season has already started, and the area at greatest risk is the holiday playground from south of Rockhampton to the New South Wales border. Mike Wassing is acting commissioner from Queensland's Fire and Emergency Services, and he says Cyclone Debbie produced a lot of vegetation growth that's since dried out.
With the severe weather patterns of Tropical Cyclone Debbie, is it rips the canopies out of the trees, and that obviously then puts fuel load onto the ground, but also exposes that ground to much more sunlight than it would normally be, and therefore exposes that to the sunlight and therefore to fire, and significantly increased fire behaviour as a result.
Western Australia's floods earlier this year only worsened the forecast fire season. Peter Norman from Western Australia's Department of Fire and Emergency Services.
That just increased fuel loads with grass growth and obviously increased dangers now that that has cured and dried through the driest winter and autumn in 5 years.
The fire commissioners in Sydney for the Emergency Management Conference urge the public to be prepared with their fire plans.
Have that conversation with your family and loved ones. Download a bushfire survival plan. Take the time to work through it. The little things you do now could make all the difference should you be threatened by fire this season.
Peter Norman from WA's Department of Fire and Emergency Services, ending Serena Locke's report. In Papua New Guinea, the Australian government and other foreign donors spend hundreds of millions of dollars trying to treat well-known diseases like HIV, tuberculosis and malaria. But there's a medical problem that kills more people than all of those combined, a lack of access to safe surgery and anaesthetics. Only 20% of Papua New Guineans can access basic surgical services within 2 hours of their homes, far below the global benchmark of 80%. PNG correspondent Eric Chorchek reports.
Papua New Guinea's chief anaesthetist, Duncan Dobunaba, is one of only 23 in the entire country. He says that means it's nearly impossible to provide specialist anaesthetic services to most of Papua New Guinea's 8 million people.
Firstly, I don't have enough coming through my training program to be able to go out. And if I don't get people coming in, I can't satisfy government requirement in providing the service.
Most of PNG's district hospitals, which serve people in remote areas, don't have a functioning operating theatre. Even the big provincial hospitals use specially trained anaesthetic nurses to ensure surgeries can proceed. Dr. Dobunaba says he'll struggle to find enough specialists to service new hospitals and wards that are being built, some with aid money.
Currently, we've got Segoroka Hospital is being built. Four operating theatres. I need to provide enough staff to provide a quality service there. They've got an 8-bed ICU. Do I have enough staff to run an ICU up there? Straight answer to you, no.
International health organisations measure whether a country is providing adequate access to surgical care by asking what proportion of its population can access basic surgical services within 2 hours' travel of their home. A good figure is 80%, but leading Papua New Guinea cardiothoracic surgeon Noah Tapawa says in PNG the number is just 20%.
I feel so bad because I know I can provide it, but given the resources and the time, because one of the things that we are looking in this as part of the indicators is the how quick they can access that service within the 2 hours. And many of them, while waiting, it will be 3 months, 2 months, and whatever they have is already inoperable. And what we call soritomas, I just tell them, and they go back home.
Dr. Tapawa says surgical services, particularly the training of anaesthetists, need to be given greater priority.
It is indeed a big problem in our country, and it's not well recognized. So I would like to see it as a number one priority for our government to look at them.
Australia is the biggest foreign aid donor to PNG, and the Australian government spends hundreds of millions of dollars on health programs, hospital upgrades and services in Papua New Guinea. Sydney anaesthetist Michael Cooper chairs the Overseas Aid Committee of the Australian and New Zealand College of Anaesthetists. He says Australia should consider how it can help PNG improve surgical services.
I think healthcare in any country reflects on its security in the region. So if a country has got poor healthcare, it's going to become unstable, and that will affect security in our region.
The first priority will be to train more doctors and support more of them to become anaesthetists.
There's only 50 new doctors come out each year in PNG. Now, that's barely keeping pace. We could use 35 of those 50 to become just anaesthetists each year to help try and fill the gap in anaesthetists. And that doesn't account for everybody else. They've got to be paediatricians, surgeons, obstetricians, all the other specialties. So there's a lot of support needed at that level.
Then PNG needs to address many other problems that affect its people's access to hospitals, particularly roads, before its fast-growing population can expect safe surgical services near where they live.
Eric Chorchek with that report. There's a dispute brewing over who'll pay to replace the cladding used in the construction of one of Brisbane's main hospitals after it was found to be a fire risk. The Queensland government says it'll take 18 months to replace the cladding. The nurses' union says the health department shouldn't have to foot the bill. But who is responsible for remediating buildings constructed with the hazardous material? Catherine Gregory reports.
The building material at Brisbane's Princess Alexandra Hospital has been under the microscope since the deadly Grenfell Tower fire in London earlier this year. And now it's been confirmed the building's cladding is actually more combustible than previously thought.
It is clear from the facade test that the cladding on the PA hospital should be removed. The hospital will continue to operate safely and provide vital healthcare services for the people of Queensland.
Yeah. That's Queensland's Public Works Minister Mick de Brenny. He says the process of removing the cladding and replacing the building with non-combustible material will take about 18 months. However, he does point the finger to the industry.
It is clear to me, Mr. Speaker, that the scenario that we are faced with is emblematic of a systemic failure in Australia's building regulation system. I have made this a priority of regulators at a state and territory and Commonwealth level, and Queensland will make sure there is comprehensive reform to the building code system.
The Queensland Nurses and Midwives Union welcomes the removal. Union Secretary Beth Moll.
Safety has to come first, if there's any doubt whatsoever. The cladding has to be removed. And this is a problem for the whole of the country, not only in regards to hospitals, but so many other buildings.
Beth Moll is adamant, though, that the health budget not be compromised by the remediation costs.
With Department of Public Works action, and so it should be met outside of health budgets, is our view. It should not be resulting in any cut to health budgets as a result of this happening. It'll have to come from general government revenue.
Mick de Brenny says the government is considering how the costs will be met. The ABC program Four Corners revealed Australian suppliers of the cladding knew it was highly flammable more than a decade ago. 40 Queensland government buildings are being investigated for the hazardous material, but it's unknown how many non-government ones are at risk. Brisbane-based fire engineer Chris Sheeran says there's not enough education in the building industry around cladding.
People who come and given that check, they would have checked all other aspects but would not have looked at this. Could have been a possible reason. Because all this is coming to light in the light of the tragedies that are happening around that we're seeing in the news.
The question again is, who foots the bill for safety audits and possible remediation? Strata Community Australia's Simon Barnard says unit owners may be liable.
The body corporate could find itself in a situation where it's got to meet a massive amount of costs to rectify this issue. They don't have insurance, they can't get insurance for their building, and there is no government help.
Mick de Brenny also points out new laws that passed in State Parliament recently means the regulator, the Queensland Building and Construction Commission, can potentially take action against companies.
This legislation that we passed through Parliament and the powers that the regulator now has are very broad, and they can address building products that pose a risk to homeowners and consumers.
Queensland's Public Works Minister Mick de Brenny ending Catherine Gregory's report. And that is all from me tonight on PM. I'm Ashley Hall. Thanks for being with me this evening. Stay listening. Here's Elise Morgan with Business PM.
Thanks, Ashley. Well, the crisis on the Korean Peninsula could risk lighting the fuse on a destructive trade war. US President Donald Trump has threatened action against China and any country that does business with Pyongyang. And that list is long and headed by China. Australia would be among the biggest losers if it happens. It comes at a critical point in China's future, with the appointment of new party leaders due next month. Jeff Raby is an economist and former ambassador to China. He now runs a business advisory firm in the country and is on the board of Yancoal. I spoke with him from the ABC's Beijing Bureau.
Jeff Raby, how seriously would Beijing be taking trade war threats from President Trump?
I think quite seriously. They see President Trump as an unpredictable leader, and they clearly are prepared for the worst. But Trump's threats seem to ebb and flow. So I think for the moment, they would be very much taking a watch-and-see position. The behaviour of the US, as China's behaviour, is constrained very much by WTO rules and norms. So the room to manoeuvre is limited. US has enormous interests in China. And so I think the rhetoric runs high and hot, but the reality is that any trade measures would, I think, be quite moderate.
I want to move on to the most important date of China's political calendar, which has now been set for next month, the key gathering of the Communist Party taking place every 5 years. Now, it's at these meetings where the president is sort of elected and Xi Jinping is expected to get another term. But there's going to be some key changes elsewhere. Now, what direction, who will they be, and what direction do you think that they will likely to be taking the Chinese economy in?
Many people are looking at this Congress not so much thinking about the political lineup for the next 5 years, but rather what happens in 2022 when Xi Jinping finishes his 10-year term. Now, that's a customary term, but he may choose to break with the norms and customs and stay on. And I think this Congress is particularly interesting in trying to understand what Xi's leadership will be like for the next 5 years and beyond.
Because his big thing has been a focus on the economy, a focus on shaking out corruption. And then in the last few months, we've seen a huge crackdown on capital leaving China and making sure that it stays in the country, which has ramifications for Australia in particular. So do you think he's going to continue with that path and have people come on to that senior leadership team that will keep that in place?
Well, I think the first foremost is that he'll be looking to continue economic growth. They have a target for 2022 to become a moderately prosperous or well-off economy. He's declared that he will achieve that and he's well on the way to achieving it. That would involve a doubling of China's GDP between 2010 and 2022. Mm-hmm. He will want to achieve that growth target, and that will be the 100th anniversary of the Communist Party. So I think we can be confident that Xi Jinping will want to see growth continue. He has around him a fairly able economic team. China has some big problems, as we know, but it's managed its way to this point quite effectively. What you're seeing with Xi Jinping, though, is a re-centralisation of economic control and economic power with the amalgamation of some huge state-owned enterprises into even bigger behemoths. And so I think you'll see more statism and perhaps less market, which is not what we expected 5 years ago when she came into power.
Jeff Raby, it's been great to have you on the program. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Australia's economic prospects are brightening, with recent data raising hopes that the economy grew faster than expected over the past couple of months. Some key figures released earlier today have taken economists by surprise, showing trade and government spending have jumped. It's prompted economists to revise up their forecast for the GDP print due tomorrow. Here's Rebecca Hyam.
The gloomy clouds hanging over the Australian economy have lifted a little. Exports in particular were tipped to weigh on growth following the big fall in iron ore prices over the past couple of months. However, today's official trade figures show net exports came in better than expected.
Now economists believe that the economy grew by around about 1% in the quarter and by around about 2% over the year.
ComSec chief economist Craig James there. A big jump in government spending has also boosted growth over the period. Government and public enterprise investment surged 12% to almost $24 billion. Westpac senior economist Andrew Hanlon.
That's a very strong result, and it's 0.5% of GDP. So I think the big story is that some of those fiscal pressures that were there a couple of years ago have well and truly passed, and you're seeing governments, particularly on the East Coast, which have enjoyed very strong revenue growth, are looking to invest in major projects.
Craig James says a rosier picture of the economy is emerging, and he's optimistic about where things are headed.
It is a very, very positive picture in terms of the Australian economy. Now, it has been very much economy driven by the housing sector, but we do know over the next few years that it will be infrastructure spending on things like roads and bridges, you know, so hospitals and schools that will be adding to the growth.
But Westpac's Andrew Hanlon is more cautious, citing a few risks to how fast the economy will continue to recover.
The real question is where to next, and there's a difference of opinion there. The RBA expects growth to lift further above trend. We think that might be a stretch. We're looking at a downturn in home building activity, and that will dwell in activity, and we see the risk that growth sort of is pretty lacklustre next year.
Both economists agree that Australia's export performance is solid, but today's figures revealed that lower prices for key commodities like coal and iron ore drove a blowout in the current account deficit. It doubled to just over $9.5 billion in the June quarter.
Rebecca Heim reporting. Well, the music industry fought it, but now music streaming services are seeing music revenues grow for the first time in a decade, with an estimated 100 million people signing up to listen. Sweden's Spotify is dwarfing rivals as it prepares to list on the US stock exchange. But despite the number of users, it's still struggling to make a profit. Here's Joanna Nicholson.
From records to cassette tapes, music videos and CDs, the music business knows change.
The music industry has been going through an evolution for more than 20 years, brought on by being an early canary in the coal mine, if you will, around digital disruption, that's really challenged all of the traditional business models and continues to challenge business models as new ideas and new platforms evolve.
That's Paul Mason, the Director of Music at the Australia Council. The value of recorded music peaked at around $24 billion in 1999, thanks largely to CD sales. It then saw a decade of decline, hitting a low of around $14 billion in 2014 as digital downloads and music piracy took over. But with the rise of paid subscription services, streaming revenue went up by more than 60% last year. Everybody hands go up! In the world of streaming, one giant is emerging. Mark Mulligan is the Managing Director of Media and Technology Analysis Company, Media Research.
So you've got Spotify way up front with 60-odd million subscribers, Apple with something close to about half of that, and then the rest really sort of come quite far behind it.
Starting in Sweden in 2008, Spotify offers access to over 30 million songs. Like competitors Pandora and YouTube, Spotify offers a free service if you don't mind ads, but 60 million people worldwide pay Spotify $12 a month for the ad-free app. But despite rapid growth in users and revenue, Spotify isn't making a profit, primarily because of large licensing payments to record labels. Mark Mulligan again.
Unless something changes fundamentally in the streaming business model, no streaming service is going to make money anytime soon.
Spotify could be on track to become the Google of the music streaming world. But unlike Google, a dominant Spotify will struggle to make money.
Joanna Nicholson reporting. It's been a volatile session on the local share market. Stocks clawed back early losses to end almost flat. The share market just shrugging off the fact that the RBA didn't move interest rates yet again. The Australian dollar is rising a short time ago. It was buying 79.5 US cents. And that's all for Business PM. I'm Lise Morgan. Good night.